This is the Meiji at 150 podcast. I'm Tristan Gruno. On this episode, I'm talking with Dr. Steven Erickson, Associate Professor of History at Dartmouth College. Dr. Erickson is the author most recently of Orthodox Finance and the Dictates of Practical Expediency, Influences on Matsukata Masayoshi and the Financial Reform of 1881 to 1885, published in Volume 71 of Monument to Nipponica in 2016. Dr. Erickson, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Oh, my pleasure.
You've written in the past about railways and the relationship between private industry and the state. And more recently, I understand you've been working on the Matsukata deflation. Mm-hmm. And so when talking about the modernization and industrialization of Japan in the Meiji period, we so often focus on the built forms, the railways, the mm-hmm. lighthouses, the telegraphs, mm-hmm. but maybe forget that this must have cost money. So could you yes. talk about the fiscal condition of the state and how they were able to balance all of this building and the budgets at the same time?
Yeah. So the main sources of revenue, you know, tax revenue was the fixed land tax. That accounted for something like 4/5 of government revenue. And then you had a number of indirect taxes, right, consumer taxes. And the most important of those was the sake brewery tax, which was equal to all of the other indirect taxes combined. You know, so as far as the revenue stream, those were the main sources. You know, there's a little bit from tariffs from customs, but of course those are fixed at a very low level under the unequal commercial treaties imposed by the Western powers, you know, sort of fixed at more or less 5% of the value of imports and exports as well. But the main way the government made up for deficits or shortfalls was to print money. You know, they basically printed fiat or, you know, inconvertible money. So in the case of government notes, government paper money, it was from 1872. And then in the case of the national banks, these private banks that were chartered by the government, it was from 1876. They were issuing irredeemable notes. They were not backed by gold or silver, which was actually flowing out of the country because of chronic trade deficits. In fact, almost every year of the 1870s, Japan ran a trade deficit, other than the deflationary year of 1876. It was the one year where there was a sort of a positive trade balance, but then it went right back to negative balance, I guess. So you have the government and these banks printing money to pay for projects, to, in the case of the government, to make up budget deficits. And the government also printed so-called supplemental notes, which were meant to be just temporary. But whenever there was a shortfall in revenue, you know, they would issue these. But basically, the government kept them on the books. And it wasn't until Matsukata became finance minister that the finance ministry actually moved to retire those supplemental notes. So those are the main ways that the government paid for all these nation-building projects. You know, they faced some real difficulties there, but the critical period comes when the government settles the cost of suppressing the Satsuma Rebellion, so the last and greatest samurai rebellion, and that happens in 1878, the year after the rebellion was actually quashed. You know, so the government and national banks issue a huge amount of additional inconvertible notes, and that eventually sets off, by 1879, just runaway inflation, currency depreciation. And in 1881, under Matsukata's predecessor, Sano Tsunetami, who was a finance minister briefly, 1880 to 1881, the government embarks on austerity, right? It embarks on retrenchment and increasing taxes, all the things that we associate with the Matsukata reform. Actually, pretty much all of it began under Sano. And then Matsukata intends to continue these policies. And the one thing that he does follow up on is establishing a convertible currency, you know, stabilizing the currency. And so from 1882 to mid-1883, he actually contracts this bloated money supply at a kind of frenetic pace. He retires all of those supplemental notes that had been issued to cover budget deficits, and then he begins to retire regular government notes, fiat notes. And as a result of this drastic currency contraction, there's a pretty serious deflation and depression in Japan. And beginning in 1883, this is, I argue in my new book, the book manuscript, Matsugata begins to turn towards more positive policies, expansionary policies. And he proposes plans to promote exports, to borrow not only domestically, but overseas. He tries to sell government bonds in England and Germany. Those collapse because of a failure to negotiate an exchange rate between the silver that Japan was going to pay on the principal and interest of the bonds and the gold that, say, England and Germany, the standards that they were on, they couldn't agree on an exchange rate because of silver was just depreciating rapidly in the middle to late 1880s and on. And so Matsugata begins to move away from a kind of deflationary policy quite early. And this is very different from the widely accepted view of the Matsugata reform, where the emphasis usually, I think in most textbooks, they'll say he slashed spending and he hiked taxes and thereby restored value of currency and stabilized the finances and so on. That's not the case. He actually increased spending during the Matsugata reform. At the beginning of the reform, instead of asking ministries to cut their budgets, he asked them to freeze them for 3 years, and then they could increase them beginning in 1885, he said. But in fact, because the yen would appreciate during that time as he carried out his currency reform, it actually meant a real increase in spending, the freezing of budgets. But beyond that, though, Matsugata was forced to basically approve additions to budgets because of various unexpected happenings, including a cholera epidemic, and in the case of the depression that hit Japan as a result of his currency contraction, and there were various peasant rebellions as a result of that. There was spending to deal with that problem. And then you also have the military demanding expanded budgets. And the other side of the, what's usually maintained is that, Matsugata increased taxes. Well, he did. He doubled the sake tax, but that was not for currency reform or financial reform, but rather for armaments buildup, to meet the demands, especially of the Navy. And this was in the aftermath of major anti-Japanese uprisings in Korea in the first half of the 1880s. And in fact, even though he doubled the sake tax, instituted a number of other indirect taxes, as a result of the depression that he largely caused by his currency contraction, taxes actually dropped and stagnated for the rest of the Matsugata reform. In the case of the sake tax, farmers who brewed some commercial sake, but especially larger brewers of sake, were very hard hit by this increase in both the tax and in licensing fees. And what you have is a drop in demand during the depression for sake. And the production of sake actually does not recover until after the turn of the century. It doesn't recover the level in the early 1880s. And you have a spike in tax evasion of sake brewers and also an increase in home brewing, sort of moonshine, right? Increases as well, which is not taxed until later. So what I'm presenting is a somewhat different view from kind of widely held one, that the Matsugata reform, that it represented a successful example of an orthodox financial stabilization program. And I'm arguing that other than the currency reform, which was quite orthodox in terms of mid-19th century, European economic liberalism, you want to have a hard currency that's backed by specie, stabilize your currency, that Matsugata certainly carried out, and he, eventually in 1886, put Japan on a de facto silver standard, where both the old in convertible government notes and new notes issued by the Bank of Japan. Beginning, there was a preliminary issue in 1885, but from 1886, you have these new convertible Bank of Japan notes. You know, they're all redeemable in silver after 1886, and the government over time retires all of the inconvertible government notes, the fiat notes, and replaces them with Bank of Japan notes. But other than that, Matsukata's policies were actually quite unorthodox. His policies actually resemble sort of heterodox critiques of IMF-style orthodoxy in recent decades. You know, we have this Washington consensus for former Soviet bloc nations and other transitioning and developing nations, right? As a condition for loans, they have to carry out increase in taxes, and they have to privatize state industries, and they have to retrench on spending and so forth. You know, all the things that we think Matsukata carried out. In fact, most of his policies deviated from or differed from those approaches. He actually called for a greater role for the state, which is not what either liberal or neoliberal economic orthodoxy would want. He increased spending. He moved to borrow in order to carry out his financial reform, and he also relied on local intellectual traditions, rather than just this borrowed ideas from the West or from the kind of orthodoxy that prevailed either in the 19th century or the more recent one too, if we compare it to what's happened in recent decades.
As you mentioned, one of these narratives of the Matsukata deflation that we see in the textbooks is this painful retrenchment, but one that's necessary. But as you mentioned there, it does cause a depression in the countryside, at least peasant revolts.
Yeah.
I'm curious, especially on how this impacts not only the economy, but the relationship between the government and the business sector. Mm-hmm. I mean, another of these received narratives of the Meiji period, it's all about this collaboration between state and business in order to promote industry, the Shokusan Kogyo policies. Mm-hmm. It's this close working and close relationship between the two that allows Japan to industrialize. And you get these model factories that the state sets up, like the railways, the Tomioka Silk Mill, all these other model industries that government can then sell off as a way to spur the growth of private capital. Is that what's happening? Is there a change to this during the 1870s? Or maybe do we need to complicate that whole narrative as well?
Yeah. So the 1870s, certainly there is this partnership between the government and private enterprise. You know, the government is subsidizing various industries, shipping in particular, right? It provides subsidies to Mitsubishi, and the state itself is heavily involved, as you say, in model factories. You know, the usual view is that, they weren't particularly successful, right? These state enterprises, they may have been important for introducing technology and certain ideas about industry, but they really, for the most part, didn't become profitable or successful until they passed into private hands, is the normal view. And for the most part, I think that's true. You know, many of the textile firms that the government set up were just not appropriate for Japan. And there's an interesting difference between cotton spinning and silk reeling, I think. You know, so the Tomioka silk reeling mill was actually too large, too big, and sophisticated for private entrepreneurs to copy, mainly because they would tend to establish mills on a smaller scale and have more kind of hybrid technology using wood and so forth for the reeling equipment and so on. And so the Tomioka mill, just did not serve as a really good model. And then in the case of cotton spinning, it was almost the opposite, that the government mills were too small to capture economies of scale. And there, you can really make a strong case that private initiative was much more important than the state in in cotton spinning, which of course became the main, the leading sector of industrialization as we move into the late 1880s, 1890s with those company booms. And in the case of, like the Sakai, the Sakai cotton spinning mill, there are a couple of mills that the government set up. Again, they were too small, and the model for pretty much all successful cotton spinning companies in the Meiji period was the Osaka Spinning Company, founded by Shibusawa Eiichi, who's as Peter Deuce very nicely put it, the Johnny Appleseed of Meiji business, Meiji capitalism, who helped found like 500 joint stock companies. But that Osaka spinning mill was much larger, and it did much more efficient and could capture those economies of scale. And that became kind of the prototype or the model for the really successful companies like Kanegafuchi and so on. But the usual view is that once we get to the Matsukata reform, we have a privatization, right? The sell-off of these government enterprises. They almost all of them pass into private hands, other than the railroads. The government hangs on to those, and then of course arsenals, telegraphs. There's some other sectors that the government retains, but it sells off pretty much all the factories and non-military factories and mines to the private sector. So we have a shift towards a more laissez-faire economy is kind of an argument you often hear. And I think Chalmers Johnson, in his book on Miti and the Japanese miracle, he argues that Japan moved more or less in a laissez-faire direction under Matsukata. And that I'm questioning. I'm saying that the government remained pretty actively involved in the economy. It did not move in a sort of a non-interventionist direction. And, the government continued to provide subsidies. Maybe it was more indirect involvement, but indirect involvement was critical, particularly at the time of, say, the 1890 financial crisis, Japan's first modern financial crisis. The government played a huge role in preventing private railroads from folding. They provided a couple million yen in subsidies and had the Bank of Japan extend loans on the security of railroad stocks, which was a huge boon to the railroad companies and railway stockholders. And the Bank of Japan also lent money to holders of stock in the Nihon Yusen Kaisha, the shipping company that spun off of Mitsubishi. It also lent money to the Kanegafuchi Spinning, Cotton Spinning Company, to various banks and so on, other banks, which it was not supposed to do. The Bank of Japan was supposed to be a purely commercial bank. But there's another case where Matsukata diverged from orthodoxy, that instead of choosing the British model, the Bank of England, as the model for his bank, he chose the Bank of Belgium, National Bank of Belgium, where the state was much more heavily involved in supervising the bank. And he moved in an even more statist direction by looking to German, the Reichsbank, in terms of the kind of note issue, a much more flexible kind of note issue along German lines. And then with this industrial financing, which went against the bank's own rules, just went ahead and were lending money to at least the holders of stock in various private companies. But I also argue that even the direct involvement of the government is still pretty significant through the Meiji period. It's not like the government totally withdrew from direct involvement in the economy. And you have these arsenals, right, both naval and army munitions works. You also have railroad workshops, and these continue to be major centers for the diffusion of technology and even personnel to private railway makers and munitions makers. That some of the government workers would move into the private sector, and they would also share their technology. And when we get into the 1890s, there's a kind of re-entry of the government into the industrial sector, where you have the Yamata Steelworks, right? The first integrated steelworks in Japan is a government enterprise, and it's finally begins operation in 1901, and the government in the 1890s steps up the construction of state railways, and eventually in 1906-1907, buys out the major private railroads. So there's a pretty significant state involvement in the economy. On the question of the privatization under Matsukata, it's true that most of these factories and mines that the government had established and run, that they were handed over to the private sector under Matsukata, but most of them were not sold until very late in his financial reform. It's really not until 1884, 85 that most of these are handed over, after his currency contraction had pretty much run its course, the currency deflation. So that's another way in which he kind of departs from at least a more current IMF orthodoxy, where privatization has to happen quickly and right away as you move into financial stabilization. And what I found is, the common view understanding is that the vast majority of these enterprises were losing money, so that it was not just a desire to promote private enterprise, but it was also a desire to cut losses, the sale of these enterprises. But in fact, of 10 enterprises that the Ministry of Public Works, the industry ministry, sold, only two were actually running in the red when they were sold. Most of them were actually making some money, and the other thing is, when we get into the Matsukata reform, the government continues to pour money into railroads and mines, and so that government spending on industry actually increased in the first 3 years of the Matsukata reform compared to the previous 4 years. So from 1877 to 1880, industrial spending actually dropped during those years, so that in a sense, the real retrenchment in industrial spending took place before the Matsukata reform, although after 1884, you do see a pretty significant drop in spending as the government moves more or less in a direction of indirect support of private enterprise, though still having a hand, as I say, in major sectors. And initially the government tries to unload its factories. Many of them were running in the red, those run by the home ministry, and some of the textile mills and so on. But only, I think, two enterprises were sold in the early 1880s. And it really wasn't until the mid-1880s that you begin to have, more accelerated sale. And because there were just so few takers for these factories, initially the government set very strict conditions for the sale. They wanted to get a good price for their enterprises. It was not a fire sale, bargain basement sale from the beginning. But beginning it in 1884, they basically relaxed the requirements. So the buyers of these government enterprises didn't have to pay the full, investment that the government had made, and it was a much easier payment schedule. And the government was looking not so much to recoup its investment as it was to find buyers who could run the enterprises. Right? So they were often leased to private businessmen, and then after they had shown that they could run them, then they would finalize the sale. So that was the case, for instance, with the Hyogo shipyard, which was sold to Mitsubishi. So it leased it for 3 years and then bought it. And then the final phase of this divestiture program was the sale of the most profitable mines. So the government even sold its hugely profitable coal and metal mines. That began in 1888 with the sale of the Miike coal mines to Mitsui. And there's a kind of fishy story there that Mitsui outbid Mitsubishi by 2,000 yen, I think, and the total price for Miike was equal to the price of all the other enterprises sold by the government, and that Miike coal mines became the sort of dorubako, the dollar box of Mitsui. It basically financed its expansion into all sorts of sectors. And Mitsubishi, sort of licking its wounds after losing out for the big prize, in 1896, which is kind of the culmination of that whole government enterprise sale program, it bought the very rich Sado and Ikuno, the gold and silver mines from the government. So even those were sold off to the private sector. Now, those enterprises, especially the gold and silver mines, they had been handed over to the imperial household. This was part of an effort to consolidate the financial independence of the imperial household before the opening of the Diet, when the parliament could mess with things, just avoid that, and so that they would have a secure source of funding in the imperial household. But ultimately, it was decided, you just have to invest so much money in updating the mines, and you have to compete for labor with private mines. Let's just get rid of them. So they eventually sold those to Mitsubishi. But the other thing that Matsukata did during his reform was he convinced the government to pass a peer's hereditary, estate law, I guess it is. And so he basically gave big chunks of stock in state subsidized companies, private companies, to the peers, to the newly established aristocracy, including himself. Right? He basically enriched himself as well. And so they got stocks in the NYK and the, Japan Railway Company and various banks, Yokohama Specie Bank and so forth. And he also had huge blocks of stock in the Bank of Japan, the Yokohama Specie Bank, the NYK Shipping Company, handed over to the imperial household too. So in a sense, the imperial household became kind of almost like an investment arm of the state, and it went on to buy stocks in a sugar manufacturing company and various other private industries. And so you have the imperial household and the peers, the new nobility, as kind of proxy investors for the state, you might say. So here's another kind of indirect sort of involvement of the government in the private sector.
You mentioned Shibasawa Eichi as kind of Japan's Johnny Appleseed. I mean, we could also think of Iwasaki Yatoro with the Mitsubishi firm or the Mitsui firm, and these big companies that were active even prior to 1868. And these are often seen as one structural reason for Japan's rapid industrialization following 1868, along with what you've been describing as people like Matsukata with very sophisticated economic thought, vibrant commercial economy, all of these things that are said to be setting up Japan very, very well structurally for rapid growth. Even as Bob Bailey said, the Protestant ethic within Japan that positioned Japan so well to modernize rapidly. Is this still a valid narrative? Can we complicate this narrative a bit now? Or how has this idea changed?
No, I think that overall, it's still valid. There are important carryovers from the Tokugawa period. So certainly domain monopolies, in Satsuma and other domains provide a sort of precursor to state enterprises, you might say, in the Meiji period. So John Sagers at Linfield College, he wrote about the Confucian origins of Meiji capitalism and focusing especially on those Satsuma leaders like Matsukata, who very much drew on their experience of sort of mercantilism and these sort of domain monopolies from the Tokugawa period. And you have a number of sort of preconditions, right, that really lay the groundwork for industrialization after 1868. So you have just to name a few of them, you have the rise of a money economy, you have a kind of a proto-national market emerging, in large part because of the alternate attendance system, right, where the daimyo had to spend every other year in Edo and to pay for these grand processions and their whole set of residences in Edo. They had to market their sort of local products in Osaka and Edo. And so you begin to have a kind of standardization of prices and so forth, you know, as a result of that. You have pretty sophisticated financial systems emerging in part to support this alternate attendance system. And in the countryside, you know, Thomas Smith, for example, you know, talked about the dynamism of rural industry, of rural manufacturing in the late Tokugawa period, right? So sericulture, you know, raising silkworms and paper making and weaving and so on. And that these kind of cottage industries, you know, were kind of a breeding ground for the sorts of skills that could be readily applied, for the most part, readily applied to modern industry, particularly textiles, right, is the kind of leading sector in the Meiji period. So there's a number of ways in which one could argue that the Tokugawa really paved the way for modern economic growth. And this is an argument that Sidney Craucour, you know, that Australian historian of Japan, he wrote several articles on the preconditions from the Tokugawa period. So very much emphasized that viewpoint. But I think we underestimate the obstacles that had to be overcome. And so Henry Rosofsky actually has this wonderful article in a book he edited way back in 1966. It's called Industrialization in Two Systems. And the article he wrote was about Japan's transition to modern economic growth. And he emphasized the obstacles, you know, the various things that had to be hurdled, you know, to for modern economic growth to begin. And he mentioned, for instance, you know, certainly the semi-autonomous domains, which meant that you have, although you may have a proto-national market emerging, there's still all these divisions within Japan, not a unified, you know, transportation network necessarily, although we're moving in that direction in the Tokugawa. And also you have just the agrarian orientation of the ruling class, which saw agriculture as the foundation of the nation. You know, that thinking, it didn't go away overnight. You know, it took a while for government leaders to recognize, you know, the importance of industry, right? And the Iwakura mission from 1871 to 1873 was kind of a real eye-opener for some of the more conservative government leaders who were just amazed at what they saw in the West. You know, I think one member of the mission said, you know, nothing grows from the ground. They're just black smoke rises from everywhere. You know, it sounds like an environmental nightmare, but, you know, for him, this is really impressive. You know, the industry was kind of the way to go. You know, on the other point you kind of raised, which is how rapid industrialization was in Japan, I think we also overemphasize the rapidity of that industrialization. You know, that it really took Japan several decades to achieve industrialization on a broad front. You know, that, I mean, you have the beginnings of modern industry in the Meiji period, but, you know, at the time of, say, the Matsukata reform, the first half of the 1880s, of the total labor force in Japan, only 2% were in modern industries. You know, and traditional industries like sake brewing, you know, hand weaving, those accounted for over a quarter of the labor force. And agriculture, forestry, they accounted for the rest of the 70%+, you know, of the working population. And the point emphasized by, for instance, Nakamura Takafusa, the leading economic historian of Japan, you know, is that the traditional industries continued to be just vibrant well into the 20th century until even the 1920s. And it's really not until World War I that that manufacturing industries accounted for more than half of industrial output. You know, that the majority of industrial output in the Meiji period was coming from the traditional sector, you know, and I think we sometimes forget that, you know, the actually the biggest manufacturing industry for much of the Meiji period was sake brewing. That was like nationwide, right? And it was, the biggest source of revenue, tax revenue for the government after the land tax. So those kinds of traditional industries remain very important. And it's probably not until maybe even World War I that we could talk about industrial revolution, Japan going into industrial overdrive. Although some would counter by saying that, the Meiji period was absolutely crucial. You have the establishment of a legal, financial, communication infrastructure. You have major breakthroughs in industries such as textiles and as well as steel and chemicals. That all comes in the Meiji period. So it was important foundations, but I would still argue that you really see just the beginnings of industrialization in Meiji, and it's probably not until World War I that you can really speak of a, industrialization, a kind of self-sustaining industrialization that doesn't rely on the output of agriculture to sustain it, which was kind of the Meiji model, agriculture as the pillar of industrialization. It's not until the 1920s, agriculture sort of hits a plateau, but modern industry takes off, as we get into World War I and interwar periods.
The Meiji at 150 podcast is hosted by Tristan Gruno at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver, Canada. This podcast would not be possible without the cooperation of the UBC Center for Japanese Research and the technical assistance of the UBC Faculty of Arts ISIT. Find out more about the Meiji at 150 project, including the Meiji at 150 lecture series, digital teaching resource, and workshop series by visiting our website, meijiat150.arts.ubc.ca. Thank you for listening.